Brilliant. Okay, lovely. So, Steph's work focuses on the ways in which post-colonial literature in English bears witness to the suffering engendered by colonial oppression. As we all know, having read the study, he explores a number of case studies which investigate the specificity of colonial traumas in relation to the hegemonic trauma discourse. He also examines how and to what effect the memory of the Holocaust is evoked in literary texts that connect the Nazi genocide of the European Jews with other destructive and catastrophic histories, such as slavery, colonialism, and other genocides. He also has research interests in literary responses to climate change, the representation of perpetrators, and imaginings of Europe and the Congo. And turning to his paper for today's keynote, which concerns these interconnections between Holocaust memories and other traumatic genocides and suffering. His paper today will explore the ways in which the Native American poet Sherman Alexie negotiates various comparative perspectives on the Holocaust. And the title of the paper is The Holocaust and Comparative Genocide in the Poetry of Sherman Alexie. Steph, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Sonia, for that very generous introduction. I'd like to thank Larissa and Sonia for organising this wonderful symposium, and which is on a topic that's very close to my heart, obviously, and for inviting me also to come and talk to you about my research. I'm very happy to be here. It really is an honour and a pleasure to give this lecture. Some of you may have heard a truncated version of it at a conference a couple of months ago. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to present the whole paper today, which I hope makes more sense this way. The starting point for it is an argument that I developed towards the end of my book, Postcolonial Witnessing, Trauma Out of Bounds, where I contend that one of the things that would need to happen for trauma studies to become decolonized is that the inherent relationality of trauma should be recognized. Traumatic colonial histories not only have to be acknowledged more fully on their own terms and in their own terms, as I argue elsewhere in the book, but they also have to be considered in relation to traumatic metropolitan or first world histories for trauma studies to redeem its promise of cross-cultural ethical engagement. Different histories of suffering, particularly the Holocaust and colonialism, should be viewed as intertwined rather than as separate. In this paper, I will discuss attempts to theorize the interrelatedness of the Holocaust and other histories of victimization against the background of, firstly, the recent broadening of the focus of memory studies, of which trauma studies is a kind of subfield, from the national to the transnational level, and secondly, efforts to bridge a disciplinary divide between Jewish and postcolonial studies, which prevents the Holocaust and histories of slavery and colonial domination from being considered in a common frame. In so doing, I will highlight the pitfalls as well as the possibilities of bringing different atrocities into contact, a challenging and often controversial endeavor that holds both perils and promises. Next, I will explore the ways in which Native American writer Sherman Alexie negotiates various comparative perspectives on the Holocaust in two of his poems. The game between the Jews and the Indians is tied going into the bottom of the ninth inning, a solid-length poem that considers Jews and Native Americans as similarly oppressed ethnic minorities, and Inside Dachau, a long meditative poem that describes Native Americans' reflections on visiting the site of a former Nazi concentration camp. Memory emerged as an urgent topic of debate in the humanities in the 1980s. The last few decades have seen a profusion of important work on memory, leading some to speak of a memory boom. Early work in memory studies focused on the ways in which memories are shared within particular communities and constitute or reinforce group identity. Very often, most notably in Pierre Nora's monumental Lieu de Mémoire project, the nation state has been taken as paradigmatic of such mnemonic communities. In the last 2 years, however, the transnational and even global circulation of memories has moved to the center of attention. The emphasis in memory studies has shifted from static sites of memory to the dynamic movement of memory. And arguments about the transnationalization or the globalization of memory typically refer to the Holocaust, which is still the primary archetypal topic in memory studies. In the second half of the 1990s, for example, Alvin Rosenfeld, Eileen Flansbaum, and Peter Novick called attention to the so-called Americanization of the Holocaust. The transnational resonance of the Holocaust did not stop there, though. In The Holocaust and Memory in the Global Age, Daniel Levy and Nathan Snyder argue that the global spread of Holocaust discourse has generated a new form of memory, cosmopolitan memory, which they define as a memory that harbors the possibility of transcending ethnic and national boundaries. In their view, as in Jeffrey Alexander's, the Holocaust has escaped its spatial and temporal particularism to emerge as a common moral touchstone in the wake of the Cold War. The negative memory of the extermination of the Jews can serve as a universal moral norm, they argue, and thus help foster a human rights culture and advance the cause of global justice. In the past decade, however, Levy and Snyder's book and Alexander's essay on the social construction of moral universals have been accused of being naively optimistic about the consequences of the global dissemination of Holocaust memory. As many commentators have noted, Levy and Snyder, as well as Alexander, largely ignore the fact that the Holocaust is often used in ways that do not lead to greater transcultural understanding and the establishment of a universal human rights culture. Dirk Moses, for example, argues that the Holocaust is typically invoked not with the cosmopolitan effect that Levy and Snyder suppose, but, quote, to express the fear of collective destruction, the apocalypse of genocide, a usage which contributes towards terroristic political action in the form of preemptive strikes and anticipatory self-defense to forestall feared destruction. The employment of Second Holocaust rhetoric by Zionists in Israel and George W. Bush's repeated use of Nazi comparisons to rally support for the war in Iraq are cases in point. As Andreas Hussen and Miriam Hansen have noted, Holocaust comparisons can also work as Freudian screen memories, meaning that the Holocaust is remembered in order to repress other instances of historical oppression, which are more immediate and closer to home. Or they can simply hinder understanding of specific local histories. Conversely, the comparative argument can be exploited for revisionist ends and serve to normalize or relativize the Holocaust, as in the Historikerstreit, the historians' debate of the mid-1980s. Another important criticism that has been leveled, both at Levy and Snyder and at Alexander, is that their analysis is marked by Eurocentrism. Their work tends to conflate the West with the world and to treat the Holocaust, a genocide that took place in Europe and was committed by Europeans against Europeans, as a unique source of universal moral lessons that cannot be learnt from any other event. If the traditional national focus of memory studies is one explanation for why research on the interrelatedness of memories of the Holocaust and other atrocities is a relatively recent phenomenon, another is the gaping disciplinary divide that has long separated Jewish and post-colonial studies. There has been a conspicuous lack of interaction between the two fields, despite a host of shared concerns. After all, both Jewish and post-colonial studies grapple with the legacies of histories of violence perpetrated in the name of racist ideologies and imperialist political projects. In his book Between Camps, Paul Gilroy asks, why does it remain so difficult for so many people to accept the knotted intersection of histories produced by this fusion of horizons? Brian Chayette, whom I'm very glad will be joining us later today, addresses just this question in an article in which she explores theoretical impediments that prevent postcolonial studies from incorporating Jewish history into a broader understanding of a colonizing Western modernity. Continuities and overlaps between Jewish and colonial experience have remained underexplored, Shayette points out, because of the reluctance or inability of many post-colonial theorists to perceive Jews as anything other than part of a supposedly homogeneous, white, Judeo-Christian majoritarian tradition. He gives three reasons to explain post-colonial theorists' resistance to breaking down the separate spheres between Jews and other ethnicities. The past complicity of individual Jews with the colonial enterprise, think of Benjamin Disraeli, possibly also Christopher Columbus, may have been Jewish. So there's this past complicity of individual Jews. There's the history of Zionism also, which points to Jewish collusion with colonial practices that continues to this day. And thirdly, tensions in contemporary black-Jewish relations in the United States over the alleged use of the Holocaust as a screen memory for slavery and segregation. While Shayette's focus is on the diffidence shown by post-colonial studies towards Jewish studies, it is fair to say that the feeling is mutual. Indeed, further complicating the dialogue between Jewish and post-colonial studies is a strongly held belief in the uniqueness of the Holocaust among many Jewish studies scholars, most prominently perhaps Deborah Lipstadt, Stephen Katz, Daniel Goldhagen, and Yehuda Bauer. The proponents of uniqueness reject all attempts to compare or analogize the Holocaust in order to preserve its memory from dilution or relativization. Though generally speaking, there has been little interaction between Jewish and post-colonial studies, a number of theorists and historians have long recognized continuities between the history of the European Jews and the history of European colonialism. In the early 1950s, Hannah Arendt put forward the so-called boomerang thesis, according to which European totalitarianism, and Nazism in particular, has its roots in overseas colonialism. At around the same time, Aimé Césaire argued that Nazism should be viewed as the continuation of Europe's treatment of various non-European peoples in the previous centuries. This understanding of Nazism as colonialism revisited on Europe also informs more recent research in the field of comparative genocide studies by scholars such as Mark Mazawa, Dirk Moses, Jacques Semelin, Timothy Snyder, Dan Stoer, and Jürgen Simmerer, who have all sought to remove the conceptual blockages in comparing modern atrocities, to move beyond notions of the Holocaust's uniqueness that might inscribe a hierarchy of suffering across modernity, and to elicit the structural continuities and discontinuities between atrocious events. Important parallel work in literary and cultural criticism has been done by Michael Rothberg, Brian Shayette, Mark Silverman, Paul Gilroy, Amir Mufti, Deborah Sanyal, Ephraim Zicher, and Linda Winehouse, among others. A particularly influential intervention is Rothberg's monograph Multidirectional Memory from 2009. Rothberg offers an alternative to the competitive memory model, shared, as he points out, by many proponents and critics of uniqueness, according to which the capacity to remember historical tragedies is limited, and any attention to one tragedy inevitably diminishes our capacity to remember another. Against this framework, which understands collective memory as a zero-sum struggle over scarce resources, he suggests that we consider memory as multidirectional, that is, quote, as subject to ongoing negotiation, cross-referencing, and borrowing, as productive and not privative. The concept of multidirectional memory, quote, draws attention to the dynamic transfers that take place between diverse places and times during the act of remembrance. Rothberg's specific concern is with the mutually enabling relationship between Holocaust memory and memories of the struggle for decolonization. While Levy and Snyder and Alexander assume that the Holocaust is central in that it allows other histories of victimization to be articulated, Rothberg maintains that the process is not that simple. Multidirectional memory is not a one-way street. Just as the Holocaust has enabled the articulation of other histories, so these other histories have helped shape the way we think about the Holocaust and affected the way Holocaust memory has circulated. In other words, the process is dialogical and multidirectional, not monological and unidirectional. The example that clinches this argument in Rothberg's book is that of Holocaust memory in France. He shows that the Algerian War of Independence helped bring about the conditions in which the Holocaust could be publicly remembered. At the time, many intellectuals pointed out that the colonial violence of the French state in Algeria, and particularly the use of torture and detention camps, echoed the methods of the Nazis. Rothberg contends that, along with the Eichmann trial, the protest against contemporary events in Algeria and in Paris helped enable the emergence of public Holocaust memory in France in the early 1960s. Besides making a theoretical argument against a logic of competitive memory based on the zero-sum game, and a historical argument about the inseparability of memories of the Holocaust and colonial violence, Rothberg also puts forward a political argument. He questions the taken-for-granted link between collective memory and group identity, the assumption that a straight line connects, for example, Jewish memory and Jewish identity, or African-American memory and African-American identity, in kind of mutual confirmation. Rothberg rejects the idea that the only kinds of memories and identities that are possible are, quote, ones that exclude elements of alterity and forms of commonality with others. Memories do not have exclusive owners. They do not naturally belong to any particular group. Rather, the borders of memory and identity are jagged. Going beyond the common sense of identity politics, Rothberg suggests that the productive intercultural dynamic of multidirectional memory has the potential to create, quote, new forms of solidarity and new visions of justice. However, he also recognizes that multidirectional memory can function in the interest of violence and exclusion instead of solidarity. In studying texts that connect the Holocaust to other historical tragedies, literary critics have tended to focus on prose works that put the Nazi genocide in contact with the brutality of slavery or the violence of the decolonization process. One thinks, for example, of the work of André Schwarzbart and Carol Phillips, analyzed by Rothberg in Multidirectional Memory, the writings of William Gardner Smith, discussed by Gilroy in Between Camps, the various novels about the Algerian War of Independence, studied by Silverman and Sagnal, in Palimpsestic Memory and Memory and Complicity, respectively, and the fiction of Salman Rushdie, Philip Roth, Muriel Spark, Sadie Smith, Carol Phillips, and Anita Desai, explored by Chayette in Diasporas of the Mind. In the remainder of this paper, I will complement these approaches by discussing two poems by Sherman Alexie, which consider the Holocaust in relation to the genocide of the Native Americans, and which exemplify a wide range of possible ways to think the Holocaust and other mass atrocities together. Before I go on to analyze Alexis' poems in more detail, or in some detail at least, I would like to briefly contextualize them by pointing out that the use of Holocaust rhetoric in relation to Native American history, which comprises genocidal warfare, land theft, ethnic cleansing, disease, and cultural destruction, is hardly uncommon among Native American scholars and artists. Indeed, the devastation and suffering inflicted on the indigenous peoples in North America since the arrival of Columbus in the Caribbean in 1492 is widely thought of as a Holocaust in its own right, and is frequently also called that. Many Native American intellectuals refer to this traumatic history as the American Holocaust or the American Indian Holocaust. Like other minorities in the US, Native Americans use the Holocaust to articulate and demand recognition for their own people's suffering. It suffices to look at the titles of a number of popular studies of Native American history to see how established this practice is. For example, Russell Fulton's American Indian Holocaust and Survival, Population History Since 1492, David Stannard's American Holocaust, Columbus and the Conquest of the New World, and Walt Churchill's A Little Matter of Genocide, Holocaust and Denial in the Americas, 1492 to the present. One could also point to a frequently cited article by Lillian Friedberg, which is titled Dare to Compare, Americanizing the Holocaust. Unlike Novick, Rosenfeld, and Flansbaugh, we invoke the phrase Americanization of the Holocaust to designate the process by which Nazi genocide of European Jews has moved to the center of American culture. Unlike these people, Friedberg uses this phrase to express her desire for the United States to finally acknowledge its own traumatic genocidal past, so the atrocities experienced by the Native Americans, and for them to acknowledge this and recognize it as another Holocaustal history. As Friedberg observes, while the Nazi genocide has achieved mainstream recognition in Germany and around the world, the genocide against the indigenous inhabitants of North America continues to be, quote, denied or dismissed as the inevitable prelude to the rise of the greatest nation on earth. Artists have been no less hesitant than scholars to draw parallels between the genocide of Native Americans and the Holocaust. Consider, for example, the documentary American Holocaust, When It's All Over, I'll Still Be Indian by Janelle Romero, which compares the Nazi genocide to the US government's treatment of Native Americans and its lasting effects on their culture today. Romero's film, which you can watch online, shares its main title with an album by Georgie Jessop, a singer-songwriter and activist, which contains 10 songs describing the plight of the Native Americans. In the field of literature, the anthology Eating Fire, Tasting Blood, Breaking the Great Silence of the American Indian Holocaust is also noteworthy. Edited by Mary Jo Moore, it brings together Native writers from many different tribal backgrounds from across the Americas who call attention to their traumatic history and protest whitewashed versions of American history which deny, trivialize, or normalize the suffering of the Native Americans. Alexis' work offers a particularly thoughtful and sophisticated literary engagement with the question of the comparability of the Nazi genocide, which goes beyond a straightforward appropriation of Holocaust terminology to validate an occluded history of victimization. A poet, novelist, and filmmaker, Alexis, who self-identifies as a Spokane Coeur Indian, has self-reflexively invoked the Jewish Holocaust from the start of his career in relation to Native American history. As Nancy Peterson points out in an insightful article that traces these references throughout his work, Alexis' various explorations of the interconnections between Jewish and Native American historical experiences reflect a significant ethical engagement with issues attached to genocidal histories and our use of them. Included in his poetry collection First Indian on the Moon from 1993, the game between the Jews and the Indians is tied going into the bottom of the ninth inning is one of Alexis' first poems to contemplate the interrelations between the Holocaust and the genocide of the Native Americans. It can be seen as a programmatic prelude to the more extensive, comprehensive, and elaborate treatment of this theme found in the later poem Inside Dachau from his 1996 collection The Summer of Black Widows. These are the two poems that I want to look at in the remainder of my talk. The Game is a multidirectional post-memorial poem that seeks to move beyond a competitive understanding of the relationship between different historical traumas towards a more dialogical, collaborative, and inclusive perspective. The speaker appears to be a Native American who is in a love relationship with the addressee, who is presumably Jewish. Could also be the other way around. He wonders whether their intimate touches will evoke traumatic memories of Native American massacres in his partner, Sand Creek, Wounded Knee, and of the Holocaust in him, Auschwitz, Buchenwald. He answers his own question in the negative, adding that, and this is line 7, we will only think of the past as 1 second before where we are now, the future just 1 second ahead. His reluctance to admit such memories of genocide can be accounted for by a desire to fully inhabit and enjoy the present moment of love without distractions or interruptions. However, there is also the suggestion that history must be bracketed because the lovers might begin to compare their histories and to compete for most victimized status. The suggestion is reinforced by the title of the poem, which casts the Jews and the Indians as competing teams in a baseball game that is about to be decided. This is a baseball scoreboard for the benefit of those of you like me aren't all that familiar perhaps with American sports. The game is described as tight, but the eventual outcome can only be a win for one team and a loss for the other. The incongruous and irreverent sports metaphor satirizes the competitive memory model which it is implied the United States imposes on ethnic minorities. Baseball, after all, is an all-American pastime. Jews and Indians are forced to compete for public visibility and recognition of their respective genocidal histories. Jewish and Native American suffering cannot be remembered together. The collective memory of one group has to win over that of the other, which it inevitably screens out or hides from view. That this pernicious competition is generally seen as having been won convincingly by the Jews is evident in Inside Dachau. In this poem, however, the memory battle is presented as still undecided. Importantly, though, the speaker of the poem goes on to qualify his blanket refusal to accept the burden of his and his partner's traumatic historical memories. In the closing lines, he raises the suggestion of a possible alternative to memory competition and comparative victimology. I quote, "But every once in a while, we can remind each other that we are both survivors and children and grandchildren of survivors." The poem ultimately refuses to play the game of competitive memory and resists its presumed inevitability. Instead, it gestures towards a multidirectional model in which different historical memories enter into dialogue and mutually inform one another rather than cancelling each other out. This move from competition to multidirectionality can also be found in the much longer and more complex poem Inside Dachau, Alexei's most sustained and profound comparative engagement with the Holocaust to date, to which I will now turn. This seven-part poem shares the thematic focus of the earlier poem, bringing memories of the Nazi genocide and the genocide of the Native Americans into contact. It explores what it means to become a responsible witness to the Holocaust, raising difficult questions about how separate histories of mass suffering and their legacies can be brought together in a productive, mutually illuminating manner. The poem interrogates the appropriateness both of using the Holocaust as a metaphor, as a lens through which to look at other histories, and of treating the Holocaust as a radically unique event incomparable to other atrocities. It does not shy away from evoking Native American history through Holocaust allusions, thus analogizing these different historical traumas. However, it ends by embracing a metonymical logic that sets Jewish and Native American experiences alongside one another, preserving the distance between them. What prompts these reflections and meditations is a visit to the site of the former Nazi concentration camp in Dachau by the speaker and his partner while on a trip to Germany, which is recounted in the first section of the poem. This is a map showing the location of the Nazi concentration camps and extermination camps. Dachau is a medieval town in southern Germany, close to Munich, one of Germany's largest cities. And it was home to Dachau is over here, right? And it was home to well-known concentration camp, which opened as early as 1933. It was actually the first concentration camp established by the Nazis. During the next 12 years, an estimated 200,000 people were imprisoned there, two-thirds of them political prisoners, one-third Jews, of whom some 30,000 died there. Dachau holds an important place in American public memory because it was only the second camp to be liberated on the Western Front. The first one was a sub-camp of Buchenwald. It was liberated by the US Army on the 29th of April 1945. As a result, it was also one of the first sites where the full scope of the Nazi horrors was exposed to the Western world through journalistic reports and newsreels. The speaker of the poem and his partner lie to their German hosts about their plans for the day, telling them that they intend to spend their time searching for rare albums in Munich. It's not entirely clear why the lie is necessary. After all, the German hosts are quite open about the Nazi past, They always spoke of the camp as truthfully as they spoke about the seasons, and they admit to feeling guilty about it. We are truly ashamed of Dachau, is what they say. A possible explanation is that the speaker's initial reasons for wanting to visit the camp, to find inspiration for self-centered poetry about the horrors that took place there, are not entirely honorable. And I quote from the first section of the poem, "Once there, so once in Dachau, I had expected to feel simple emotions, hate, anger, sorrow. That was my plan. I would write poetry about how the season of winter found a perfect home in cold Dachau. I would be a Jewish man who died in the camp. I would be the ideal metaphor." He abandons his plan to take on the identity and assume the voice of a Jewish inmate who died in the camp after realizing that things are not so simple and that his desire for identification is selfish. Indeed, there is a fundamental gap between his experience and that of the Jewish victims that cannot be bridged by metaphor. Quote, "I thought it would all be simple, but there were no easy answers inside the camp. The poems still took their forms, but my earlier plans seemed so selfish. What could I say about Dachau when I had never suffered through any season inside its walls?" The speaker questions his ability and his right as an outsider to this history to imagine himself in the place of a Holocaust victim. The fact that he is Native American does not make any difference. In fact, this or his ethnic background is not even known to the reader at this point in the poem. Of course, we tend to identify the speaker of a poem with the poet, and we are even encouraged to do so in this case by the fact that the speaker's companion is called Diane, like Alexei's wife. However, it's not actually made explicit that he is Native American until the fourth part of the poem, which uses the phrase "we indigenous people." Until then, the first person pronouns that are used could refer to any present-day visitor to Dachau, or at least any American visitor. As we will see in a minute, one of the couple's German hosts refers to the United States as "your country." In any case, the speaker's ethnicity does not give him the right to conflate his own experience with that of a Jewish Holocaust victim. In so doing, he would be appropriating, exploiting, and colonizing the Jewish inmate's experience, erasing its difference, ignoring its historical specificity, an arrogant, insensitive, indeed selfish act. While the first part of the poem thus warns against conflating distinct historical experiences, it also warns against treating them as unique and incomparable. Mikhail, one of the German hosts, asks, "But what about all the Dachaus in the United States? What about the death camps in your country?" This question may well be intended to deflect attention from German to US atrocities, presumably the US government's reservation policy and military massacres, in a manner reminiscent of the conservative position in the Historiker Streit. However, the ethical issues about the comparability of the Holocaust and Native American history that it leads the speaker to confront will preoccupy him for the rest of the poem. Still in part one, he acknowledges that Mikhail's simple questions are ignored season after season, meaning that the genocide of the Native Americans continues to be denied, and he gloomily reflects, quote, "Inside Dachau, you might believe winter will never end. You may lose faith in the change of seasons because some of the men who built the camps still live in Argentina, in Washington, Munich. They live simple lives. They share bread with sons and daughters who have come to understand the master plan." Here, and indeed throughout the rest of the poem, the speaker expresses his fear that winter will never end and that regeneration and renewal will remain forever elusive. This fear is based on the observation that the ideology of those who constructed the Nazi camps is being passed along to the next generations, both in Germany and elsewhere in the world. The poem's extensive use of highly repetitive poetic forms underlines the sense of hopelessness. These forms include the sestina in part 1, the villanelle in parts 3 and 7, and the rondo in part 4. repetition compulsion, in which the poem appears to be caught on the formal level with the same rhymes, words, lines constantly recurring, reflects the speaker's impression that history keeps repeating itself. He does not acquiesce in this state of affairs, though. The next three sections of the poem go to the roots of the problem and examine the role that the memory of the Holocaust can play in either perpetuating or confronting the denial and the resulting continuing perpetration of other atrocities. In part two, the speaker notes that by repressing knowledge of atrocities, and particularly of our own implication in them, like the Germans who claim not to have known about the Holocaust, or the Americans who continue to deny what was done to the Native Americans, we ensure that genocides will keep occurring, genocides of which we ourselves may well one day become the victims. And quote, "It begins and ends with ash, though we insist on ignoring the shared fires in our past. We attempt to erase our names from the list that begins and ends with ash. We ignore the war until we are the last standing, until we are the last to persist in denial as we are shipped off to camps where we are all stripped and our dark bodies lit by the cruel light of those antique Jew-skin lamps." The speaker is warning here of what will happen if we persist in whitewashing our own history. If we stop denying, perhaps we have a chance to escape this fate. Both the problem and the solution are captured by the title of part two, History as the Home Movie. If we treat history like a home movie and edit out or fail to record unhappy memories, that means we refuse to confront the dark chapters of our past. These chapters should be made part of our family history, it is suggested, in the sense that we should become as intimately familiar with them as we are with the kinds of events home movies typically record. The title can also be seen to problematize our tendency to narrow history down to our personal history and to ignore the suffering of others. In part three, the speaker wonders whether visiting a memorial site such as Dachau can stimulate remembrance and critical reflection. He scrutinizes people's motivation for visiting Dachau, repeatedly asking, using a generic "we," "Why are we here? What have we come to see? What do we need to find behind the doors?" A possible answer that is offered is that we may be looking for an apology from the perpetrators, bystanders, or negationists of the Holocaust. However, it is suggested that that expectation does not suffice and is unsatisfactory. After all, it could be a way of letting ourselves off the hook, of shirking our responsibility to confront our own dark past, which part two emphasized. The speaker suddenly asks the question, what have we come to see that cannot be seen in other countries, and recognizes that every country hides behind a wide door. The implication is that visiting sites of trauma in other countries may be a way for people to avoid dealing with disturbing aspects of their own past. The speaker thus criticizes the use of the Holocaust as a screen memory for more discomforting memories of events closer to home. As Lillian Friedberg points out, quote, "In the pathological dynamic of genocidal histories, the perpetrator culture invariably turns its gaze to the horrors registered in the archives and accounts of the other guys. This is why Holocaust studies in the United States focus almost exclusively on the atrocity of Auschwitz, not of Wounded Knee or Sand Creek. From an American perspective, Dachau is an even more appropriate choice for a screen memory, you could say, than Auschwitz, as Dachau was liberated by the Americans, Auschwitz by the Soviets. Hence, visiting Dachau offers Americans an opportunity to see themselves in a heroic, wholly positive light. However, as part four makes clear, it can also have the effect of making the visitor more rather than less aware of the shameful history of their country and bringing him or her face to face with its continued denial. Provocatively titled The American Indian Holocaust Museum, this section of the poem, which the speaker for the first time explicitly identifies himself as Native American, circles around three repeated lines. What do we indigenous people want from our country? We stand over mass graves. Our collective grief makes us numb. We are waiting for the construction of our museum. Part 4 stresses the parallels between Jewish and Native American history. The images of mass graves and the next stanza, shoes of the dead that could fill a city to its 13th floor, apply to both the Holocaust and the genocide of the Native Americans. Jews and Native Americans today also share a profound sense of collective grief. However, while Jewish losses are widely acknowledged and publicly commemorated nowadays, for example, through the transformation of Nazi camps into memorial sites and through the foundation in 1993 of the US Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., those suffered by the Native Americans are still officially unrecognized and not taken seriously, as is apparent from the absence of a high-profile museum dedicated to the memory of the victims of colonialism in the United States. The speaker exposes this asymmetry and calls for the establishment of a museum devoted to what the title of this section refers to as the American Indian Holocaust, which could serve the same purpose as the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in making the devastations of Native American history publicly visible. It should be pointed out that the National Museum of the American Indian opened on the Mall in Washington in 2004, so 8 years after it actually published Inside Dachau. However, this museum does not function as the American Indian Holocaust museum which the poem calls for. Rather than documenting genocide, it celebrates the rich history and culture of indigenous peoples throughout the Americas, and this emphasis has given rise to controversy. If Inside Dachau had ended here, after part four, it could be read as primarily interested in developing a comparative suffering framework to advance the Native American cause, with the Holocaust being used to highlight and demand recognition for the tragic history of indigenous people in the United States. However, the poem continues and, in the last few sections, moves towards a more multidirectional understanding of collective memory. This becomes particularly clear in part 6, which juxtaposes Jewish and Native American histories, both formally and thematically. Part 6 can be seen to resume the critique of metaphor that began in part 1 by developing a way of connecting Jewish and Native American experiences without equating them. It is made up of a series of couplets in which the speaker imagines himself to be Jewish in the first line and speaks of being Spokane in the next. The opening stanza, for example, runs as follows. If I were Jewish, how would I mourn the dead? I am Spokane, I wake. Each couplet asks a question in the first line about how a Jewish person would do certain things and makes a statement in the next about the speaker being Spokane and therefore acting somewhat differently. The overall effect of this structure is to locate provocative points of difference and connection. In the first couplet, for example, the speaker establishes a link between different mourning practices but refrains from collapsing them into one another. The assumption of easy comparability that underlay the speaker's initial plan for the poem, in which he would be an ideal metaphor for the experience of a Jewish inmate of Dachau, and the whiff of memory competition that hung over part 4 of the poem, have given way to an open-ended exploration of points of cross-cultural contact and areas of overlap between Jewish and Native American identities, which respectfully acknowledges the gulf that separates the two. The concluding section of Inside Dachau holds on to the insights gained in the previous section, with the speaker recognizing the limits of his understanding. Quote, I am not a Jew. I was just a guest in that theater which will never close. As the latter line suggests, the poem does not end happily. The speaker predicts that atrocious events will keep on happening. Quote, I wonder which people will light fires next and which people will soon be turned to smoke. While his reflections lead to a disillusioned perspective, the poem as a whole is not entirely fatalistic. A measure of hope can be found in the agency of the text itself, which performs the very process of cross-cultural mourning whose absence it laments. In so doing, it seeks to transform the reader into an agent of such mourning, as Laura Lightman has argued. As a textual memorial, Alexis' poem hopes to trigger a form of reflection in its readers in the same way Dachau triggered reflection in the speaker. The invitation extends to the reader to engage in constructive memory work by bearing witness to the horrors of the Holocaust, by acknowledging the historical traumas of the Native Americans, and by recognizing the continuing recurrence of genocide. Is the poem's modest but valuable attempt to act upon the world in such a way as to help prevent or reduce further violence. Like the game, Inside Dachau thus exemplifies not only the dangers involved in, but also the benefits potentially brought by adopting a comparative perspective on the Holocaust. As such, it is in line with recent research in the field of comparative memory studies, which is suspicious and critical of overly celebratory accounts of the increasingly transnational circulation of Holocaust memory, but not to the point of altogether abandoning the notion that something positive can come out of it. Thank you.
Steph, for that incredibly clear exposition of recent memory studies and a really illuminating and thought-provoking reading of the poetry of Sherman Alexie.